Chapter 3. At Rodina Station, first and only interstellar capital city and home of the Union of Progressive Peoples, four shifts of border watch crews tracked the approach of the wandering spacecraft, while making bets as to whether the pilot would actually have the stones to unlawfully violate UPP territory or turn aside at the last moment. If it were the former, would they send an SOS begging for help because life support was failing and they were almost out of air? Rodina Station would have to take them in, of course. All governments and nations were bound by the Benevolent Civilizations Treaty, which made it mandatory to rescue travelers in distress or face universal embargo. The UPP preferred to have no contact with decadent capitalists, but an interstellar space station couldn't survive without trade. Someone suggested the pilot might be one of those blustery libertarian anarchist sovereign persons who deliberately violated borders, refusing to recognize what they called bullshit authority because nations weren't real and nobody could own empty space. A rather exciting prospect for sure, but also highly unlikely. There weren't many blustery libertarian anarchist sovereigns around anymore. Most of them were imprisoned by some bullshit authority that didn't know it wasn't real. By contrast, the universe was absolutely infested with capitalists. When the Sulaco finally entered UPP space, it did so without even a minimal hailing signal, as if no one on board had any idea they were violating a treaty. It had been a hell of a long time since some entitled, money-worshipping, shopaholic capitalist had been so brazen. Maybe this was how they relieved their capitalist ennui. They went looking for trouble just to rouse themselves from the semi-conscious stupor brought on by compulsive consumerism. The watch crew on duty immediately hit the all-hands alert, effectively putting Rodina Station at DEFCON 1 before they had any actual information on the errant spacecraft. Then the data came through, and the anticlimax was overwhelming. Worse, nobody won the pool. Rodina's intelligence division didn't share their feelings. As an official Colonial Marines vessel, the Sulaco was a treasure trove of information that had drifted into their reach sheerly by chance. Shit happened, and sometimes it was good shit. Since it would only be accessible for a limited period of time, they had to act fast. The interceptor Rodina sent out to rendezvous with the Sulaco was an older model the manufacturer had replaced years ago, but it was hardly obsolete. The pilot made a perfect in-motion landing atop the Sulaco, directly above an airlock. He and his two-person crew had worked together before, gathering intelligence from sources not easily, or legally, accessible, under difficult circumstances. This assignment wasn't especially hazardous, but the pressure was on. The ruling council hadn't actually told them in so many words that they shouldn't bother coming back without something of unprecedented significance. But they all got the message. The commando in charge was an old-school warhorse with the old-school name of Boris, who said he was a direct descendant of the Bolsheviks who had overthrown the Russian government in the early 20th century. A bold claim, but questionable. Most of the progressive peoples at Rodina were of uncertain parentage. As well, pedigree was for animals, not humans, and thus not progressive. Still, everybody had quirks. His was harmless. The commando in the number two spot was a young Vietnamese woman who had fetched up at Rodina some years earlier on a transport filled with an assortment of the rootless, the stateless, and the hopeless. Everyone, even the non-English speakers, called her Lucky. Explaining her surname was Look and her given name was Hi was a lost cause. Occidental name order was standard at Rodina Station, like it was almost everywhere else. Nor did she try correcting anyone's pronunciation. The progressive peoples were as tone-deaf as the capitalists they scorned. In any case, she didn't mind the name. More often than not, she was lucky. Not in the superficial way involving money or material goods, but in the important way. Survival. Early in her young life, Look High had learned that the key to good fortune was being observant. Bad things always happened, to the good and the not-so-good, to the innocent and the guilty, the just and the unjust. It was simply how the universe worked. But no matter who you were, where you were, or what happened to you, chance always favored the prepared mind. The third member of the team was Ashok, and Look High didn't actually know very much about him beyond his name and his repertoire of skills. This wasn't really unusual. Most people who came to Rodina Station didn't share much about themselves. While chance favored the prepared mind, discretion was the better part of everything. Even from a distance, they could see that the vessel had sustained the sort of damage incurred in out-and-out warfare. The logo on its hull was scraped, but still readable, Weyland Yutani. It figured that the fascist military would fall under the aegis of the most corrupt operation in the galaxy. Once the interceptor was securely attached to the trespassing spacecraft, they suited up and Boris opened the floor hatch to let Look High into the airlock, closing it behind her so she could expel the air before opening the outer door. She attached a couple of decryption units to the Sulaco's airlock, waiting with one hand pressed to the access so she could feel the vibrations as the units worked. Nothing happened. She looked up at Boris, watching her through the small window of the inner door, and shook her head. He signaled Ashok, then gestured for her to wait. 15 seconds later, the airlock shuddered under her hand and it started to open. She gave Boris a thumbs up, closed the interceptor's outer door, and waited for him and Ashok to come through the airlock so they could enter the Sulaco together. The ship's gravity kicked in as the lights came up to reveal they were in the cargo hold. Look High was first down the ladder to the deck. After a quick look around, she signaled Boris and Ashok that it was safe to follow. Radios would have made this so much easier, but the commanders-in-chief for field operations had decided no frequency could be made completely secure from eavesdroppers. Look High would have pointed out that sign language wasn't completely secure either, but at her present rank, she wasn't qualified to offer criticism. All she could do was stay alert and hope she never got into a life-or-death situation with her hands full. At least the air was breathable, so they could open their faceplates. The commandos fanned out, weapons up and ready. With all the passengers in cold sleep, the place hadn't seen any activity for a long time, but Look High couldn't shake the idea that something bad had happened here. The battered dropship secured to the deck a few meters away did nothing to allay her uneasiness. Had there been some kind of armed conflict on LV-426? She couldn't remember hearing anything, but Boris might. He was looking the ship over with great interest while taking care not to get too close. Look High took a step toward him, then froze as she felt something strange under her boot. She looked down, but what she saw didn't make sense. The human legs, lying twisted and broken on the deck, were attached to a partial lower torso that appeared to have been torn from the rest of the body by sheer brute force. What was so powerful it could rip a person in two like flimsy cloth and discarded the unwanted part like trash? More importantly, was it still here? Slightly less importantly, why was there powdered milk all over the remains? Or was it talcum powder? No, she realized. It was dried up robot blood. There was an old joke about putting it in coffee, but she could never remember it because she didn't drink coffee, and it wouldn't be any funnier to her now. Before her thoughts could pick up momentum, Boris and Ashok came over to see what she was looking at. Boris made a disgusted face and reminded them that time was short, the council was expecting a hell of a lot more than broken robot legs, and they had to find a way out of here to the rest of the Sulaco. She and Ashok dutifully obeyed, Ashok looking as spooked as she felt. "Attention, please. This is a ship-wide security announcement." They all jumped. The female voice had no hint of urgency, nothing except a bland matter-of-factness. "Breach detected," it continued. "Security personnel are to proceed immediately, with full backup, to B-deck, cargo lock 3, to take appropriate action." The three of them stayed completely still, in case security personnel in the form of humans or robots actually showed up. After 10 seconds of utter silence, the voice repeated the message. Look High hoped they could figure out how to shut it off before it drove her crazy. Boris beckoned to her and Ashok from the entrance to a dark passageway. He took a step in and waved one arm around, waking the motion sensors and turning on the light. That had to be a good sign, Look High thought. If the motion sensors were still working, conditions aboard the ship couldn't be too bad, and it was unlikely they'd come across anything worse than broken robot legs. The announcement repeated only once more as they moved cautiously along the passageway, probably triggered by movement, Lukai thought. And now that the security system no longer detected anything moving around the deck, it assumed the situation had been resolved. Capitalist security was such a joke. The passageway took them to the cold sleep chamber. As soon as they entered, lights flickered on, but only at half strength. Lukai wanted to believe the passengers probably knew the lower setting would be easier on the eyes when they woke up, but she'd never been any good at lying to herself. Her misgivings intensified as she looked around at all the empty capsules. Their open lids gaped like sterile beaks. All, that was, except the first four capsules in the row nearest to where she was standing. Gesturing for Ashok to have a look around the rest of the chamber, Boris moved slowly to the first occupied capsule. Lukai followed him, keeping her weapon up and ready. There was nothing out of the ordinary about the first three capsules, a woman, a little girl, and a marine. Status lights on each one indicated they were functioning perfectly, and the occupants all looked normal, although the marine had sustained injuries to his face and upper body, burns of some sort. Bandages hid most of the damage, but he'd need treatment when he woke up. The last capsule, however, was trouble. The condensation on the inside of the lid was the same milky white as robot blood, and Lukai didn't think it was a coincidence. If the top half of the robot was in there, something had gone very, very wrong. Lukai stood back as Boris attempted to pry the capsule open by forcing his gloved fingers under the edge of the lid. He wasn't having much luck, and despite the bulky vacuum suit, his body language clearly indicated he didn't want any help. Fine with her. She didn't want to help him. She wanted to stop him. But she knew better than to try. Boris didn't react well to a subordinate questioning his actions. On the other hand, he'd react a lot less well if he had to leave his legs behind when they went home. Letting out a frustrated growl, Boris punched the capsule. Lukai's jaw dropped. Boris was often gruff, but he was calm gruff, not given to displays of temper and not tolerant of those who were. The impact instantly jolted him out of his anger fugue and back to himself. He turned to her and gave a faint, embarrassed laugh.
"That's called percussive mode. Learned it from an engineer."
Lukai barely heard him. She was staring at the capsule, now slightly off kilter on its base. The red and green status lights on the end flickered for a couple of seconds before they went off. There was a soft clunk as a lock released, and then the whited-out lid slowly lifted away from the bed. Dense white fog flowed over the edge of the capsule in graceful billows. Lukai tried to pull Boris away with her, but he shook her off with an emphatic gesture to keep her distance. She took another step back, half expecting the fog would turn to liquid when it hit the floor, but it only disintegrated. She started to say something to Boris about leaving, then saw that all the fog had cleared away to reveal some kind of egg-shaped thing sitting in the middle of the capsule. Or, more precisely, growing. Its roots indistinguishable from the ragged guts of the robot's upper torso. The egg didn't have a hard shell. It looked rubbery and wet, like something a reptile would produce. Had the capitalists programmed their machines to reproduce like robot lizards? Was it more economical to have robots grow their own? Unease increasing, Lukai moved around behind Boris to move up on his left. Now she saw a few shreds of plastic under the robot's head, the remains of a medical catastrophic injury cocoon. Wasting medical treatment on a machine was yet another example of capitalist stupidity, but she couldn't work up much indignation about it. There were probably 24 cocoons untouched in their supplies, and none of the humans needed them, not even the marine. The robot's head rolled to one side and its eyes opened, staring directly into her own with an expression of suffering on its face. Lukai felt an intense dropping sensation in the pit of her stomach. No machine could actually suffer, whether it was a centrifuge, a spacecraft, or a robot that looked like a human. Her gaze traveled from his face along what was left of his body to the egg growing out of his torso, which was also impossible. Nothing grew out of inanimate objects. At the top of the egg, flaps suddenly unfolded with a moist, fleshy smacking sound. Boris took a step back just as something sprang out of it, hitting his face with a splash of ugly yellowish liquid. Look High jerked back, avoiding a large blob that landed exactly where she had been standing only a moment before. To her horror, it began eating through the metal with a loud hiss, which was quickly drowned out by Boris's screams. Look High turned to see Boris was still on his feet, even as the thing from the egg sank through his helmet and into his head. The creature looked like a three-way cross between a snake, a jellyfish, and a squid. His screams became muffled, then took on a strangled quality as he staggered backward, clawing at the creature with both hands as he turned and broke into a clumsy run. Leaving Ashok to fend for himself, Look High closed her faceplate and followed him into the passageway at what she hoped was a safe distance. Her helmet was filled with the sound of her own terrified breathing, but she could still hear Boris's cries of pain as he headed for the cargo deck in an off-balance, stumbling run, sometimes hitting one wall and rebounding off the other. She kept waiting for him to fall, wondering what she would do when he did, how she could possibly help him. Somehow, he made it all the way to the cargo deck and kept going for almost a half minute before he finally fell face down, 3 meters from an airlock marked emergency only. Look High used the barrel of her rifle to roll Boris onto his back, hoping it was over. The creature's body was pulsing now as he clung to life, his hands making feeble swipes at the thing. Or maybe those were just spasms. He couldn't possibly be alive with a monster eating his head. Slinging her rifle, she drew her sidearm and then hesitated. Boris was past caring, but after all they'd been through together, it felt disrespectful to shoot him in the face, even if he didn't really have one anymore. On the other hand, he'd have ordered her to make sure the thing was dead no matter whose face it had landed on. She moved out of range of blowback and took aim, then closed her eyes as she pulled the trigger. The mess of bloody tissue, fragments of bone, and helmet were dissolving even more quickly than the metal deck underneath. Other small holes were opening up all around wherever pieces of the creature had landed, and the hissing was so much louder here, practically thunderous. Look High could barely hear her own grunts of effort as she dragged Boris by one leg toward the nearest airlock, desperate to get them there before he fell apart. Muttering an apology to Boris for the unceremonious treatment, Look High hit the open button beside the hatch, shoved him into the airlock, and punched emergency expel. A red light overhead started flashing as the inner door snapped shut and a siren went off. Look High closed her eyes, feeling the vibration as the airlock opened and spat Boris's body into the void. The siren cut off as the outer hatch closed and the airlock was repressurized. Look High remained still, counting her breaths and willing her pounding heart to slow down. Although her commando training wouldn't let her fall apart until she was back in her quarters, she needed a few seconds to pull her shit together. It had just been a mission to gather intel. Get in, get the data streaming, get out, and get gone, leaving no sign they'd displaced so much as a molecule of air. A simple mission, and about as safe as any espionage mission could be. It was supposed to be safe. Should have been safe. Would have been safe if they had just set up a data transfer conduit from the cargo deck without investigating anything else on the ship. If they had, they would have been back on the interceptor, monitoring the big fat data stream from the Sulaco. Boris would have been telling them about their mistakes, in between bullshit fairy tales about his glorious Bolshevik ancestor, not flying headless through the void. And she'd have been a little bored, not traumatized. While Ashok, her heart began pounding faster again as she realized she was no longer alone. She'd been so stupefied she hadn't sensed something creeping up behind her. Hell, she hadn't even noticed that the hiss of acid eating through metal was nowhere nearly as loud as it had been. Look High swallowed hard as she straightened up and turned around. The monster standing at the mouth of the passageway had multiple limbs sprouting at weird angles from an irregular bulk atop 2 legs. As she raised her weapon, the thing stepped forward and turned into Ashok, carrying half a robot in his arms. The right half. Ashok was so smart, she thought. The robot would contain data that wasn't in the ship's computers, and they were legally allowed to confiscate it as suspicious tech aboard a trespassing spacecraft. It would give the UPP an even greater advantage than they'd thought. When they returned to the Interceptor, Ashok locked the robot in the quarantine box. They put themselves through Decontam 3 times during the return trip and twice more on arrival, just to be on the safe side. Still, Lokhai couldn't scrub the image of the robot's face from her mind. She told herself not to anthropomorphize, but she couldn't forget how relieved she'd felt when they'd closed the quarantine box and the robot hadn't looked like it was suffering anymore.